Welcome to episode 185 of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts Andrew, David, and Jen. This week, we read Captain Marvel in Pursuit of Flight by Kelly Sue DeConnick. And now, the cast begins.
Well, again, we're going this weekend.
See things then. Except that it was fucking awesome! Although, you know, truthfully, though, you know, it was really good. Like, really good.
What?
And a lot of people I've read stuff online where some people are saying it's the best Marvel movie. I don't know if it's the best, but it's really freaking good.
Yeah, OG Iron Man was amazing.
I don't know if it's... I think if I try to, like, think about it realistically, I think my favorite Marvel movie might be Winter Soldier.
I finally saw that this weekend.
And?
I liked it.
Guardians... Okay, so here's what I... This is what I will say about Guardians of the Galaxy. Star Wars Episode 7 is going to have its work cut out for it if it's going to out Star Wars Guardians of the Galaxy.
Interesting.
You know, the best part is that they're both owned by the same parent company, so they could actually blend universes now.
I hope they don't.
But seriously, you don't want a Star Wars, Han Solo Star-Lord crossover?
No, because it would be like... Then they might as... Do you know what they should do? They should bring Indiana Jones into that, and then it'll be, like, a movie about triplets.
Wait, does Disney own Indiana Jones?
I don't know, but there's an Indiana Jones ride at Disneyland.
Oh, well, then, yeah, they do.
Well, yeah, didn't Disney buy out LucasArts at some point?
Well, yeah, but Disney owns Lucasfilm.
Yeah, and yeah. Lucasfilm owns Indiana Jones.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Well, then shit.
And even before Disney owned them, they had a pretty good, close relationship.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, like... Star Wars and always had a huge presence at Disneyland and now. Anyways, but it's a cool movie. Seriously. I was very pleased with it.
Awesome.
That's good.
Well, it's weird. It's like hard. It's hard for me to, like... The thing that's tough is, like, you guys know how much I love that comic, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know what I... Like, I don't know what my expectations were going into the movie. And I... And, like, after I watched it, I felt like, yeah, that was a pretty awesome movie. I felt like kind of like confused and tired after I watched it. Not because of the movie itself, but because I wasn't sure how I like from an emotional standpoint, I was confused.
I like that. That's excellent. I want to go watch it and be confused emotionally as well.
But seriously, as far as like as a movie goes, it's a good movie. And as a Marvel movie goes, it's in, like, the top three Marvel movies. Definitely.
Man.
It was awesome.
Ugh.
I think part of me scared that maybe, like, the hipster part of me is scared that it's going to become a Tumblr darling.
Oh, yeah.
And then...
I think it will.
And then... And I'm going to be, like, sitting here being like, get off my lawn, hipsters. I was into this before. I liked Guardians of the Galaxy before it was a movie. Which is really dumb.
No, I don't think you'd be like that, though. Because the nice thing about that, it will come up on Tumblr. There will be a bunch of gift sets from the movie. But there will also be more people having read the comic. And you'll get more, like, of the pictures of the comic and more, like, fan art of the comic. It'll just be more.
But see, the part of the thing is, though, is that I loved that the Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning run a lot, and you know, that's why I love Guardians of the Galaxy, the property. And the current Bendis run is good, but it's not as good as the one that spun out of Annihilation.
Hmm.
And the movie is basically, I mean, the movie is its own thing. I don't even know what I'm trying to say.
I don't know either. Just they're similar but different.
Yeah, and I know that. Like I know that there's some like comic book fans who get upset when things change between the movies and the comics, and I don't have a problem with them being different because they're not the same universe, you know.
Yeah, and it's not the same medium. I mean, you can't do the same things.
And they do, and there is a lot of like fan service in the movie. Like there's lots of really cool things like nods, and I don't want to say anything because I want you guys to enjoy it on your own. But I don't know. I think it makes me just miss the Dan Abnett stuff. And I mean, I could read it. I have all the issues, you know, but I don't know.
But it's the making the concerted effort to go back and do it.
Yeah. But there's a lot of cool stuff in the movie. There's a cameo by a celestial.
Ooh.
He's not really part of the story. That's why me saying it doesn't really ruin anything. But it's pretty badass when he shows up. It's like a flashback kind of thing. But it's cool. Go watch it.
Okay. I'll do it this weekend. Okay. Deal?
No, do it right now.
God damn it.
Okay. Can we do this like tomorrow then?
What? The podcast?
The recording, if I'm going and doing it right now.
No, just go after we're done.
Okay. Does my wife need to come too?
I think if you just pull the sheets before you go, she'll probably be okay.
Yeah, that fixes everything. All right, everybody, welcome to another aeronautical episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with David.
Sup, dog.
And Jen.
Hello, ladies.
This week, we read Captain Marvel in Pursuit of Flight, collecting issues 1 to 6 from the Captain Marvel run from 2012, written by Kelly Sue DeConnick, and art from Dexter Soy. So, this is the second comic in our Comics for Ladies series of shows.
God, and this is like the worst, like, who...
Exactly. It's like, there's no way to say it that isn't smarmy.
No, not at all.
No. So, this week, last week we read Red Sonja, which was like, really, can you have, like, a four ladies comic with Red Sonja as the main character in her, like, in her plate kini? But this week,
like a male Keeney.
Yeah, not even plate.
But M-I-M-I-L, not M-A-L-E. Just want to make that clear since we're talking, this is comics for ladies.
Yeah, yeah. So this week, though, this week we picked the one that's kind of like, it's a Tumblr darling. As soon as it came out, it was all over Tumblr. And I think part of it isn't just that it plays into what the blogosphere on the internet surrounding comics and feminism and female characters and women creators, it plays into all of that. But also, Kelly Sue DeConnick is one of the most engaged creators I know. She's on Twitter, she's on Facebook, she's on Tumblr, she's communicating with her fans all the time. She helps some of her bigger fans, like, plan and promote meetups for, like, she calls it the Carol Corps. And, like, she's really into her community, and I think that is fucking awesome. So I just wanted to mention that up front. Like, I think this isn't just a Tumblr darling because it hits all of the notes that Tumblr looks for. I think it also is because Kelly Sue DeConnick is a phenomenal person in the comics world, and she deserves hella credit for that because it's a lot of work to do that on top of your actual, you know, writing work.
Yeah, for sure. And, I mean, if you do follow her on Tumblr or any of the, you know, the internet's places, you know that she is also a mom and stuff. So she, you know, she's a hardworking lady, and she does a really good job, like Andy said, of getting and being connecting with her fans. So, you know, I follow her on Tumblr, and I do, you know, I'm not one of the people that, like, asks her questions and stuff, but I like reading the fan interaction and stuff. So it's really nice to have that kind of connection with the audience.
Dude, and I love when she, like, when she reblogs all of the stuff that her fans create. Like, they go out and they make dresses and hats and all kinds of things.
Yeah, people make some awesome, like, track jackets that look like Captain Marvel's costume.
That's so cool.
It's awesome. And she's fun to follow just to see that stuff. But actually, you mentioned the costume, and I guess it kind of transitions naturally. That's something I really want to bring up. I fucking love this costume for Captain Marvel. Like, it fits her. It's got, like, a faux military kind of thing going on, and it's a full-body suit. Oh, my God. You can have a leading character that doesn't have insane cleavage or, like, butt floss.
No chainmail bikinis.
No, and it was great because it's a costume that also does make her look powerful and still is, you know, the skin tight suit, but it's like, it's
functional?
Not, yeah, a little bit. And even the accessory she has, like the scarf belt thing, I don't know what the word is for it.
Sash?
Yeah, probably sash.
Scarf belt.
Oh, no, man. I don't wear them. And then, like...
Wait, you don't wear a scarf belt?
No, I should, though. I'll do that tomorrow. Instead of getting, instead of wearing a belt, I'll just, like, twist up a scarf and tie it around my waist. Fuck, where is it going? Yeah, even that thing has usefulness. Like, in the first issue, when she uses it to take down Absorbing Man, like, it's not just purely decorative.
Oh, my God, you know, I didn't realize that that's what she was using.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, where'd she get... There's, like, some kind of cloth thing.
Well, I mean, that's reasonable. Oh, the helmet just comes out of the neck piece. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, but I didn't, like... It didn't didn't occur to me that that was the belt sash.
But that, aside from being functional, that also, like, it carries over from her old costume, you know? Like, her old costume was just, like, a one-piece bikini with... That's not a thing you can do. It was just a one-piece swimsuit, basically, with that sash on it. And she just brings the sash into this and does a really good job of breaking up the design of the costume. And it just... I don't know. I think it's great because her old costume didn't make sense for who she was as a character. She's a major in the Air Force. She's a strong, independent person. And her character and who she is as a person, she wouldn't choose that costume. I don't believe that she would have. But this is something that a person like this would choose to wear. Like, this is a choice they would make. And I love that it upgraded the character from the very first impression that anybody gets when they see Captain Marvel, when they see Carol Danvers. It's now going to be something that makes sense and not Ms. Marvel's crazy swimsuit, basically.
Yeah, and it looks just far more official. Like, you know, it has, like, the striking lines and symmetry that you would get in, like, a military uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the little details. Like, I love her buttoned gloves. They're not just, like, stretchy gloves. They're buttoned on, and it makes me think of, like, I don't know, official, like, military dress uniforms of, like, the 1800s or something. I don't even think that's correct, but, like, that's the feeling it evokes. And, like, I enjoy the formality.
The high collar and everything.
Yeah. No, I think she has, like, this is a completely reasonable costume to fight crime in, right? It's, like, stark synthetic material, so you know it's safe to wear, and it's svelte, so you can fly around without, like, getting caught on birds and shit. No, think about it. Like, if you have a giant cape and you're flying around, you're gonna catch on things. It seems really unsafe. So her costume just seems really practical.
I just love that it just gets caught on birds. Yeah, and it's just...
Bird strike.
And I feel like, I mean, the costume is something that gets brought up all the time when people criticize comics. And, like, the big problem with Red Sonja last week was that if you had a... The premise for this is comics to get your women... to get your woman into comics, right? That's the list that you see online. And Red Sonja won't work. Because even if your lady friend is into sword and sorcery adventure comics, they're going to see Red Sonja covers and be like, I don't know, this looks kind of pervy to me. But if you show them Captain Marvel issue 1, they're going to be like, all right, this is a superhero in a costume that's not significantly different from like what Superman wears or Captain America wears.
Andy, that's going off a stereotype that women don't like pervy comic covers.
Yeah, I know. There's nothing...
There's some ladies who really like some, you know, anime, and no offense, Jen.
Yeah,
Tarot the Black Rose.
Lesbians, right?
Yeah.
We are the most. I don't know what's happening people. Here.
This is what happens when you get a fat white nerd to comment on feminism.
Jen, how about you just do the rest of the podcast, and Andy and I will nod agreeingly to you. No, I'm just kidding.
I just mean, like, I would feel so much more comfortable handing this to my wife and saying, give this a try, than handing her Red Sonja.
No, I get that. I think that kind of
definitely.
Also goes
definitely.
For, like, this seems a little more safe in terms of comics in general, too, because it's like, I don't know, the covers really tell you what's going, like, what you're going to be given here. It's a woman in a superhero uniform, she looks strong, she's gonna fight some crime, deflect some bombs, do the kind of, you know, Cape comic standard thing. It's, I don't know, you can look at this comic and it feels like a pretty reliable choice to give somebody and say, like, hey, maybe if you like superheroes, you should try this.
Yeah. Which... Again, it feels so silly to have to comment on this. It feels so silly to have to make a point of it. But you do, because when you go to a comic book shop and you look at the racks of comics, you see racks.
This is true.
Get it?
I knew you were gonna go that way. Yes. Okay.
Then how come you didn't laugh, you godbook? Come on. No.
We laugh.
So let's talk about the woman inside the costume. What did you guys think of Carol Danvers? Have you ever had... any encounter with her as a character before, like as Miss Marvel?
We've seen her a couple times.
I had not read... Oh, go ahead, Jen.
I'm so sorry, we just keep stepping all over you. All I was going to say is I'm pretty sure we've encountered her in several things that we've read for the podcast. That's all.
Have we? I don't know. Well, anyways, I had not read this comic, despite it being, like, very well reviewed and critically received. I don't know why I didn't pick it up. In particular, in Miss Marvel series that preceded this. I think it had been canceled for like a year or so before this comic started. And I don't know why I didn't pick it up. I think maybe I was just like trying not to have too many things on my pull list or something to that effect. But I still get, you know, I pick up all the Avengers books, and she's an Avenger, so she appears in that quite often. But you know, somebody who was a fan of Carol Danvers before this, I think this is a really good Carol Danvers comic, you know. Oh, you know where we had seen her before? We had seen her in Alias.
Oh yeah, because of Jessica Drew.
Yeah. I don't know if we saw her. Not Jessica Drew. Jessica Drew's Spider-Woman.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Jessica Jones. Jessica Jones, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jessica Drew's in this.
Yeah. Get my Jessicas mixed up. Yeah, I mean, I had read Ms. Marvel, the preceding run. I think I own all of it in singles. And it had its ups and downs. It was good and bad in places. But
yeah,
it didn't feel like that character was especially distinct from, like, the generic female character mold. There weren't an especially large number of things that really set her apart. I mean, there were the foundational bits, right? Like the alien technology, the being in the Air Force, you know, the things that automatically differentiate you, like Wonder Woman coming from the Mascara and stuff. But they're both basically like strong female character, go fit into JLA team and say feminine thing. Okay, done. And like, that's all they really were in a lot of instances. But this takes those defining characteristics of Carol Danvers and incorporates them into her personality. Like, the way she always wants to go fast and wants to be the best and wants to have the record and prove it to people. It ties directly into the way that she throws herself into the situation just wantonly without care in a lot of instances in this comic. And it takes those... I just love the way it fundamentally integrates what should be life-altering events in her past, and actually makes them matter for her character. I feel like so many times, your origin story is just your origin story, and it makes Batman the Knight, and then after that, it doesn't really inform who he is as a person. He's just a dick. When it's like, really, after like 20 years, you kind of would have gotten over it a little bit. Like, but these things integrate into Carol in a way that seems and feels realistic and organic.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. She actually seems like one of the most in-depth characters that we've read. And I'm going to say that even, like, more than some of my favorites. Like, I guess not Marvel in this case, but DC, Power Girl. Like, she is really awesome. But I think there's also kind of that sense of humor with her that keeps her from, you know, being really, I guess, emotionally resonant with the reader. You don't get that kind of throwaway humor with Carol Danvers. She's really serious, but also, you know, confident enough in herself that she throws some bad jokes around. And I don't know, she's just, I feel like she was portrayed with a really nice amount of depth here so that I could really relate to her, even though I have no shared life experience whatsoever. You know, and that was a cool thing. Like, I understood why she wanted to be who she was. I really understood that desire to, you know, strive and be competitive and not give up. And, you know, even when it seems shitty or like it would be easier. So, like, that just made her, like, so real and such an enjoyable character to me. Like, that all her motives were laid out in a way that at least I could relate to really easily, or I could see how someone else could relate to that easily.
Yeah. Yeah, and, like, a great example of that, in my mind, is in issue 5 when she's with Helen Cobb when Helen was young, and she's like, what do I do in this situation? Would I go with Helen and break into a super secure complex and do all this other crazy shit? Or do I go in back into the bar and tell that woman that her dreams can't come true because of nothing she can control? And she's like, that's easy. I'm going to go break the law and break shit.
Yes.
Like, that's great, because then you lay out you lay out the options that are ahead of her, and you see what decision she makes. And the beautiful part in that is, either way, you can empathize with the decision she makes. Like, if she decides to stay back, sure, it's probably the right decision because of the butterfly protocol, which she calls it. But really, I mean, if you had powers and you could just say fuck it and throw yourself into a situation, I would rather not do that, because that would suck going back into that bar. I'd rather go punch something. And Carol would rather go punch something. Because in this situation, Carol's pissed. She's angry, just like Alan's angry. And the only thing she can do is go with Helen and try to punch things and break into stuff.
So that was actually my favorite scene in this comic. And the reason is... I don't know if you guys are, or our listeners have heard about, like, this huge, I don't know, basically Tumblr fight that has spread throughout more of the internet, where there's all these ladies saying, you know, I don't need feminism because, and, you know, their reasons range. Like, some of them say, I don't need modern feminism, and maybe they list some good reasons based on the reactions they've gotten from, like, some people on the internet. That's... And then some are just really poorly fleshed out. But the point here is that I have, in that discussion, seen various people frame being a woman as a kind of disability. And what I love about that scene is that Carol Danvers understands that even in this context where Oklahoma, that girl can't, you know, be an astronaut because she's a girl, you know, Carol takes that as saying, okay, well... Now I'm looking at this, and I'm in a position where I can say, okay, here, society, shitty, this is your life, too bad, or I can challenge it, and come what may. And Carol doesn't even know if it's going to go well. She thinks the alien tech might react poorly. You know, there's no guarantees there, even though she's very powerful. And she still makes that choice to say, hey, you know... The joy here is in challenging the status quo. It's not even a choice. Like, I can overturn things. And, like, she as a character in that scene exemplifies to me that, no, like, this thing sometimes I hear people say, like, oh, it's bad to be a woman for whatever reason. It's just bullshit. Because you get to make your own choices as a person. And even if they don't turn out well, hey, at least you tried. I don't know if that made any sense or if I just went on like a 2-minute ramble, but
no,
whatever.
That made awesome sense.
Yeah.
That made awesome sense. And that's why I like that scene, but articulated better than I could have. I tried like 2 or 3 times to say that sentiment that you just said, and I couldn't get it, but you did. And that's awesome.
Yay.
So then is Helen Cobb like, I'm really interested in the relationship between Carol Danvers and Helen Cobb, because it's... One is a hero meeting her hero. And when they get to interact, it's so amazing to see how they are on similar wavelengths, but still, I don't know, they don't like get along perfectly.
Well, they both want to be the leader. They want to... And, oh, more than that, they both want to be the winner.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's a competition between them. There's no... I don't know. It's not cooperation by any means.
So then why did... Because at the end, we kind of get a sense that Helen did this on purpose to Carol. Gave her the plane, put the thing in the plane, and knew that this would happen. And sent her back in time to do this the way that she had done it. Like, that sense that Carol had gotten played. Because Helen would know that Carol would just throw herself into a situation and not look at the ramifications. And that's a very easy kind of person to manipulate. So, is this Helen actually trying to manipulate Carol into changing past? Because it kind of goes either way, right? Carol asks, like, did she do this to give me the choice to change my past so that I don't become Ms. Marvel and Captain Marvel? Or did she do this to take my place? Which is what we kind of get later when we see Helen all Creed up.
I don't think it's really... It's not clear... I don't know, I do kind of see where, you know, we kind of get guided to think that Helen did it on purpose, and my immediate reaction was that maybe she did it on purpose to take Carol's place, but after I thought about it some more, I didn't get the feeling that they had the kind of relationship where, you know, sure, they did compete because they were both pilots and competitive people and they wanted to be the best and they cared about breaking records and that kind of thing. I don't know, but I didn't get the feeling that Helen did it to take Carol's place necessarily. Maybe she was trying to teach her a lesson or not to forget the type of person that Carol is. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah.
I didn't get the feeling that that this was a kind of thing where Helen was the bad guy. It was like this, like, self-affirmation type of thing where Carol was reminded of the person that she could be. You know, we talked earlier about, you know, Andy, you mentioned that there was nothing really special about the Miss Marvel run. Like, she was just a generic, she seemed like a generic strong woman stereotype. And you compared her to some instances of Wonder Woman, where Wonder Woman falls into that role. And maybe this is kind of a meta, the story we read here is kind of a meta commentary on saying, because not only is Carol reminded of the type of person that she can be, or the person she maybe she should be because of the situation she's in with the powers and that kind of thing, but it's also to tell readers who you know are very familiar with Carol Danvers as Miss Marvel and say, look, this is the type of person that, you know, from this issue on, this is the person that you're going to read about. Don't, you know, it's not Miss Marvel that we had read about before. I mean, that the first discussion we get is her talking to Captain America after their fight with Absorbing Man and about her taking the name, taking the name Captain Marvel. And kind of at the end, we see that Carol has now embraced the title, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was this whole, like, journey for Carol to learn that, yes, she is worthy of this title. It's not Mar-Vell's name. It's this mantle that he carried, like Captain America said, and now he's gone, but Carol is there to carry on that legacy. Like Captain America, and if anybody knows that kind of thing, it would be Captain America, you know?
Yeah.
There was a period where he passed the title to Bucky. Even, like, Bucky took the title up after Steve Rogers died, but then there was even a period after Steve Rogers came back where Bucky continued to be Captain America and Steve was just Steve Rogers. And so I feel like it was not only a journey for Carol, but also this message to readers about that kind of set the tone for what kind of comic we're going, what kind of stories we're in for, what kind of character we're going to be following here. You know, it seems like a, kind of a meta type of thing to set the tone, you know?
Yeah, because you're right. I mean, I really love that she's presented with almost the exact same dilemma that the original Captain Mar-Vell, Mr. Mar-Vell, I don't remember what his first name is, I don't know.
Like, Mar-Vell, that's his whole
Mar-Vell.
Name. His name's Mar is his first name, and Mar-Vell. Like his, because he has his kids are Genis Vell and
Villa-Vell. So I really appreciate that at the end, Carol is given almost the exact same situation that Mar got, and she makes the same choice to save the innocent person and not worry about herself and her own future, or should I even have become Captain Marvel? Like, in that instance, all of the erudite sort of rationalization that she's trying to put on whether or not she should pick up this legacy, it's out the window, because in the moment, she has to make the decision without having to worry about all that. And when she is given that set of circumstances, she chooses to be the hero and to become Captain Marvel. And that's why, like, whatever doubt she has or you would have had as the reader are gone, because she made that choice and it's right there. Like, almost panel-to-panel comparison of the original and her.
And she's, like, still, you know, she's self-aware, too. I mean, yeah. She says, kind of, I mean, she doesn't say fuck it, but she says, like, I'm an Avenger, this is what we do.
Yeah.
And she this does the heroic Avenger thing. She acts selflessly. She doesn't understand what the consequences will be for her actions, but she knows that somebody is in trouble and needs help, and so she helps. And that's what heroes do. They you know, they rush into the to they rush in and do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I love that the Helen's flight and the T6 like set that situation up to present us with this undeniable proof that she's worth it and she knows it and you know it and the American people know it. But I still wonder about Helen Cobb's rationalization for doing it in the first place. And I think this is my theory. My theory is that Helen Cobb gave her the plane and threw her back in time and set her on this course so that Helen Cobb could get the same powers and race her that way and then settle it, because she wants to win. And if she can't win, she wants it to at least have been a fair fight. And there's this moment before where Carol says, it's not really fair because all I have to do is get out of the plane and I'll beat the daylights out of her. Where Carol is like racing up into space, right? And she times herself like a minute and a half and then she falls back down, you know? There's that moment where she's like, as much as I could have raced Helen, it still never was real because I always could have done this and she'll never have been as fast as I was. And you get them flying in the plane and there's that same competition back and forth. And I think Helen orchestrated this whole thing just to have that moment at the end where they race and where young Helen doesn't know that that's what she's there to do. But I think old Helen, when she passed away, orchestrated this for that moment.
So they could finally compete on a level field?
So they can fight and compete on the same level. And sure, maybe you're sure Carol's going to win, but at least there's no doubt anymore.
Carol doesn't know.
Carol doesn't know. No, but,
and that I think that creates the stakes and the tension. You know?
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, you as the reader, I mean, you know Carol's going to win.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But it's still like you get both of them on the same footing. And it's even a young Helen Cobb, the same age. You don't have to worry about age playing in it at all either. Like, I honestly believe it was orchestrated for that last race when they both have the Kree power.
I agree with that. And I think that older Helen Cobb and younger Helen Cobb had different motives. Because if you look at, you know, those last pages, there's the note from Helen to Carol. And she says, in all my years, for every time I stuck my fool neck out, I ain't never been scared to die. I've been scared to lose. Scared of the day when I'd give my all and somebody else would find a way to give more. Turns out it ain't so bad passing that torch, so long as you find the right person to hand it off to. And I kind of, like, that makes me think that older Helen wanted to ensure, like, she says in the note, too, that she recognized Carol from the day she first, like, stepped in. To, you know, Helen's bar. What is it, club bar thing?
Bar. It's bar. No, it's a bar.
Yeah.
That's a bar.
So, I think what she's doing in part is, you know, showing Carol, yes, you are worthy, but also saying that, or showing herself and making it happen that this person that she is passing that torch on to is worthy of this legacy, because she knows her younger self and she knows that back then, like, maybe even if she doesn't remember being a horrible dick and trying to steal the powers, right? Like, she knows that she'd be competitive and that this would be, you know, the real proof of where they each stood and a real competition, just like you said, Andy. So I'm thinking older Helen just wanted to have both her and Carol understand that Carol was worthy. And then maybe younger Helen actually genuinely wanted to take the powers.
Hell yeah, I would too after seeing all the shit Carol can do.
I would, but I really wouldn't want to steal them from Carol Danvers because she would, like, hunt me down and kill me.
Yeah, even without any power, she would.
Yeah. I would not make enemies with her.
No, I'd much rather have her as an ally. Because even as a supporting ally, she's an amazing character. Like, I really did enjoy that kind of... It almost felt like filler, but I did enjoy that filler interlude with her and the Banshees together. Like, the first time that she's thrown back into history into Peru, I think it was. Yeah. I like that moment, because it shows... You get to see Carol at work, you know? If that makes any kind of sense. Because her total tone changes. Her body language changes. The way she speaks changes. The way she interacts with them is different than the way she interacts with people in her personal life. And it's really interesting to see, like, what military Carol looks like.
Yeah, it's, I really also enjoyed the quipping because it laid it out as, like, a Marvel comic. This is Marvel. Here are some jokes. This guy's name sounds like toilet paper. I don't know. It just, you know, every time I hear a really dumb joke in comics, it establishes that universe for me. It's like, okay, we're in Marvel now.
Yeah, these people aren't as serious as DC, thank God. Well, I mean, what did you guys think of that whole bit with the Banshees and the Prowlers in Peru?
I really enjoyed it. I thought that all of the Banshees were really cool characters. Just watching them, I was like, fuck yeah, these people are awesome. Want to hang out with them. Or maybe not, because they're also kind of scary.
So are those the bits then that make this a comic for ladies?
Maybe, but you know, that's actually also my problem with the Banshees, because the whole time I was kind of like, is this interlude being brought to me by girl power? Right? Like, it felt very much like, ladies, yeah, women, okay, sure, that's fine, but like, why is it in this plot? I feel like they just, I feel like DeConnick could have tied it in a little better instead of having her randomly land here, brought by, like, you know, alien shrapnel. I don't know, it just didn't fit. It fit thematically, it fit aesthetically, it did not fit plot-wise for me. I was pretty confused as to why they were there.
Yeah, I mean, it, like I said before, it kind of felt like filler, but it did it. One of the things this comic does is showcases the role of women in pushing boundaries throughout different periods in time. And I think it's especially important to note that throughout this comic, you get one named male character, right? No, you get the one guy in Peru who sounds like Toilet. But the other named male character is Howard Stark.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the only two I can think of.
Was it Howard Stark?
No, yeah,
it was something Howard, right?
No, I think his first name was Howard. I think he was Howard Stark.
No, I don't think so, Andy.
I think so. He looks like Howard Stark. Anyway, those two are the only male characters you get, and they're both assholes.
Well, you get Captain America.
Captain America.
And Absorbing
Man.
And Spider-Man.
In the present, you get not assholes.
But I mean, their role is so minor.
Yeah.
This is not about them.
Yeah. And so I think the Banshees... It might be filler, punch, fun stuff, like punching, but they also do, they do show you how, throughout the history of women in the military, that they've constantly been counted off as not good enough for whatever reason, and here these four women took out this entire camp with Carol, but, you know, like...
No, they were badass.
They were fucking awesome, like, and there was no reason for them to be there other than that they were counted out and only allowed to do cargo runs. And that's how they ended up there. And thankfully, they ended up there, because if they weren't there, shit would have gone bad real quick.
I also like that they have such menial flying jobs. Like, one is a crop duster, a mechanic's daughter, there's a term, barn something. It's a person who, like, barnstormer. I think it's, like, a person who flies short distances, like, for passenger travel.
I don't know.
So, like, it's all, like, these menial jobs. It's not like they're flying aces or anything. And well, yet...
Go ahead.
I don't have anything.
Oh, I was going to say, I read that as... because right before they said that, they meant... the person that Carol was talking to mentioned that most of the women were from society families, and they were saying that their little group, the Banshees, were separate from them because they weren't society.
Yeah, I thought those roles were their jobs before they got conscripted. Not conscripted, but before they ended up doing cargo runs for the military.
Yeah, because The women air service pilots aren't military. We're civil service ferry pilots, fly girls helping out the cause. Most come from society families. You need to have money to get the cockpit hours it takes to qualify for the program.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever treated us like we were different, but we knew. A barnstormer, a mechanic's daughter, a crop duster. We banded together, called ourselves the Banshees, and before all this happened, we had the best record in the whole Corps. See, I thought they came together because they came from different backgrounds than the typical person in the Women's Air Corps.
Or yeah, they weren't highfalutin.
See, that actually makes me like them more, because it's like, they really wanted to do this. They weren't just given the money to get the pilot's license, right? They had to really work. That's cool.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, too. When in World War One, when they first started using flight for military purposes, I mean, a lot of people in those planes didn't even have weapons. I mean, the planes didn't even have weapons. And, like, the only way you would get to be in a position where you could fly a plane and log the hours was if you could afford to own the plane privately. So in the First World War, at the beginning of warfare with planes, it was a very small group of people that tended to know each other. Like, so you would fly by the enemy and almost wave at them because you would recognize them. Because before the war, there were so few people that did that, you know? And I mean, by the time you get to World War II, it's a much, much bigger thing. But I'm sure for a lot of people, it's a similar situation where if you want to get, especially for for female flyers. Like, if you're a dude, you just join the Air Force and they'll train you and they'll give you the hours. And it's not that hard. But if you're a woman and you want to contribute and you want to fly, you'd still have to own your own damn plane. Unless you're things like a crop duster and a barnstormer and a mechanic solder. In those situations, you can log the hours without having to be rich as hell. And so I love that that was like a thing that was in here that would have actually been true. Like, it's not just a device for this comic. It's something that actually was true in that period in history. And then I like, again, the same thing. I think there was a group of female astronauts who had the same problems that Helen Cobb's group had. I actually should look it up and see if Helen Cobb was one of those women. There were a full group of women who tested to be astronauts and went through the entire program and just didn't get to go up because they were women. I know that that's a real group, but I don't remember what they're called. I listened to a podcast about it a while ago. So I know that they really did exist, and I love that that's in here too.
That's cool. I really like it when comics align with historical facts. It's like you're learning.
It's
but
funny.
That is awesome.
It's funny, but it's true. And honestly, yeah, because whenever stuff like that happens, I have to remind myself that a good chunk of my higher vocabulary comes from things like Magic the Gathering. that day when you realize that doppelganger is a real word and not just some made-up word for a card game. That was awesome. That day was awesome. But no, I love it that the same thing is happening here, but with history. Like, you'll read this comic, and then maybe 2 weeks later, you'll see an article about these female almost astronauts, and you'll be like, holy shit, that was real. I mean, Helen Cobb and Carol Danvers might not have been real, but that really happened. And you get a good sense of what it must have felt like. You get Oklahoma and Helen's anger over the situation. And that's awesome that it puts you in history from a more subjective point of view. And that's something really powerful in comics that I think a lot of times just gets left out. And it doesn't even have to be like a super erudite kind of thing like Boxers and Saints. It can be fun like this too.
Oh, so the Mercury 13 refers to 13 American women who, as part of a privately funded program, underwent some of the same psychological screening tests as astronauts. Selected by NASA on April 9th, 1959 for Project Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a woman named Jerry Cobb.
Hey!
That was one of the 13.
Cool.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's great.
So maybe Helen Cobb was a derivative character.
And yeah. We also get Jerry from the Banshees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So Geraldine Cobb from the Mercury 13 had a mother named Helena Cobb.
Hey.
So
clever. Dead. I like that. No, that's really cool. Mm-hmm. Easter eggs. That's what we're getting here.
So what did you guys think of the art in this?
Oh, I really loved it.
Oh my god. She played for a women's semi-pro softball team called the Oklahoma City Queens. Maybe all the characters in this... Oh, she's from Oklahoma.
She's there all these people.
All the characters in the comic are her. I mean, maybe...
It could... I mean, who knows? You mean we might be joking, but maybe.
So, yeah. I don't know. I saw those.
So, what did you guys think of the art?
I love the art. I really liked the two styles, like, next to each other, too, because Dexter Soy's style was more, like, almost painted.
Yeah.
And I thought that was beautiful, and I was really into that. And then it suddenly switched, and I was thinking, this is really familiar. And it's Emma Rios from Pretty Deadly.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, issues 5 and 6, I looked at that, and I was like, it was such a shocking change, too. And I'm not sure exactly why it happened, because I don't know if it, like, well, you know, comics switch artists all the time, but it didn't seem like it fit thematically. But I really thought they were both beautiful.
Yeah, I really loved Emma Rios' work in this, too. I mean, it's interesting because, you're right, the style looks really familiar, but I think the colorist is different. So, like, it's that really cool thing where it feels familiar, but I couldn't quite pinpoint it. Because the coloring in Pretty Deadly is amazing. And not that the coloring in this isn't great also. Actually, I should go and check that before I sound like an ass. Anyway, yeah, the same thing. They both feel really good. And Dexter Soy... That opening fight works on a bunch of different levels because of his art, you know? Like, it feels... His art's really good for a fight. Because the sort of painted thing, like the motion, the action, it feels really fast-paced and powerful. Like, you get a good sense of how hard these people are punching. And And just the movement of it all works great in that opening fight. And that's what you need if you're going to start a comic off with a fight, because you have a character like Carol Danvers who opens up with a fight. Like, you need that to draw the reader in. Because you also get readers like Nick, who was a guest host a while ago, and he's like, yeah, you know, when there's a fight, I just kind of tune out, punch, 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 get back into the stuff that matters, you know? And I feel like if this is a character that they're going to try and market as being comics for women, or whatever, you know, then I think that is another gender stereotype, is that women don't like fighting, punching, action-y kind of stuff. And I think that's a dying stereotype, thank God. But if you're going to have a comic with a strong female character that's supposed to appeal to female readers, written by a female creator, and you want to open it up with a fight because that's who Carol is, then you're gonna need to make it good. And it's good. I like it.
I really like Dexter Soy's art for this comic. I feel like the whole personality of Carol Danvers is more someone that you would see, like, I don't know, in some Hall of Fame or, like, museum or recognition memorial thing, where there's like a giant oil painting of her looking very serious with her arms crossed and heroic. And I feel like the painted style that Soy's art had kind of carried that seriousness with it. Like you said, like the action worked really well, but there were also those still moments where I feel the art gave the comic this really just lovely weight.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Emma Rios's art is just gorgeous. But I feel like it's lighter. It's certainly not cartoony or funny, but it's, I don't know, something. It's far more delicate. And I don't know if delicate and Carol Danvers go together in my mind.
Mm.
I love it, though. I think it's just gorgeous. And I do like, especially when she and Helen Cobb are drawn together by Emma Rios, the way their faces look next to each other, they're so similar, but then you could like definitely tell the difference.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really nice reflection of who they are as people too.
Yeah. What was your guys' favorite scene in this, both like story-wise and art-wise? I'll tell you right now, because I was just flipping through, and one of my favorite, it stuck out with me the entire time I was reading this, and now I was flipping through issue one again. There's a full page in panel one, or in issue one, where Carol decides, in quotes, she decides that she's second name. She says, I'm taking the damn name. And it's in that moment where she's up flying above the planet after she, like, races up there, you know? And it's a full page, and the expression and everything is, like, set just perfect. That like anxiety meets anger meets determination sort of feeling that she's having in these first couple issues. Like it's drawn in her face and her body language so well in that full page and in the panels before also. But it's just, that page is great. I really do like that one.
I don't know. I liked the race at the end.
Yeah, where they're like twisting around each other.
Well, yeah, from an art perspective, it was excellent. But I also liked, I don't know, I felt like it was a culmination of the whole story, you know. It was like the sprint to the finish, literally and figuratively. The page of the race is split into, it's bordered by two large, why can't I think of the name, panels. And then there's two columns of smaller action panels. And I think it's just really, it's organized in a really neat way, you know. And then the page, it's not the next page. This is all in issue 6, by the way. It's two pages after the race where, after Carol gets into the plane and the Kree, Helen Cobb says, you win, do us proud now. I don't know. I thought that was just like a really good wrap up, you know.
Yeah.
And it was a great example of Emma Rios' art, you know, how she can make really cool, like, action and movement and stuff. So, yeah, I would say that the race in particular, but the panels before, as Carol gets into the T6 again, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Jen, did you already go or not? I don't remember.
Well, I mean, a little while earlier I talked about my favorite scene, which is when she makes the decision not to go back in the bar in Oklahoma, that she can't do a thing. But in terms of, like, where art and story intersect, it's just this one tiny panel, but I love it so much, where think it's near the beginning of issue 4. She's about to fight, like, the giant prowler eye thing.
Oh, yeah.
And there's just this little panel at the bottom where she goes, you know, I'm an Avenger. And she has this look on her face, and her hair is blowing in the wind, and, like, the shadows are really dramatic. And she just looks like such a badass. And I feel like that little panel of her where she's going, I'm an Avenger, just sums up her character so well. I think it's excellent.
Cool. The other one, a note I want to make about the art is some of the covers for this run are fucking awesome.
Oh, yeah.
How did you guys read this? Did you buy the trade, or did you read it on singles or MDCQ?
I read the singles on Marvel Unlimited.
Same.
Yeah.
Which is actually funny. So when I started reading it, I read issue 1. And then somehow I got mixed up and I read issue 5 next. Oh. And I was like, what is happening in this comic? What did I miss? And then when I finished issue 5, I realized that I had just read issue 5. So I went back and read it all over again. It was really confusing.
Dude, but out of these 6 issues, issue 5 is one of my favorites. Terry Dodson's amazing.
Yeah.
The cover.
It's a great cover.
3 is really good, too.
I feel like 2 is my favorite, though.
I guess my favorite of the upcoming ones, and probably this whole 2012-2013 run before they started renumbering, is number 9. If you guys want to look it up, issue number 9 is an amazingly beautiful cover. That's the one where she's like streaking up in space with her fists next to her, and it's great.
There's a cover where, I don't know if it's from this run, where she, I don't know why I said she, that has Spider-Man on it too.
Oh yeah, I think that's one of the variant ones, I don't remember.
I think it might be a Spider-Man cover, actually.
I think I remember the cover that you're talking about. I don't know if it is this run.
Oh man.
Anyway, yeah. These covers are great, and if you guys torrented this, shame on you. You should go buy these covers because they're beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys know how I feel. I will pick up extra issues of a comic because the variant cover is beautiful, but I also want the stock cover, or I'll buy, like, issue 38 of some random comic because I was walking down the aisle of comics in the comic book shop, and the cover stood out at me and looked awesome, so I'll just buy it for the cover. Because I'm weird like that.
It's Avenging Spider-Man number 9, where Spider-Man is, like, hanging onto Carol's back, and she's, like, blocking bullets for him.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. That is actually also a Kelly Sue DeConnick book.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I might have to start reading that one, too. Thank you, MDCU. Anyway, you guys ready to get down to write this?
Yeah.
All right, since you were so enthusiastic, Jen, you get to go first.
I'm going to give it a 4.5. This was just really enjoyable. I love Carol Danvers as a character here. You know, I think maybe we've seen her once or twice making a cameo in other things we've read, but this is my first exposure to her as a lead character, and she's great. She is, like, she is the type of person you just want to aspire to be, right? Like, she is just so badass, and she's a hero. I love her. And I think this rendition that DeConnick did of her is just a great intro to the character, saying that as someone who's just been introduced. I really like the art. I know I said, like, earlier, I didn't think that the shift in the art, like, fit that much for me. But that doesn't mean that, like, both artists didn't do just an exceptional job. I really liked it. So, I don't know. I love this comic. 4.5.
All right. David?
Yeah, I'm going to go with the 4.5 as well. It's a really good read. You know, I mean, the reason we picked this because it comes up on the books for ladies list. But this is just like Red Sonja, this is just a solid comic, you know? I think this is better than Red Sonja, and I thought Red Sonja was pretty good. But, I can't think of any, like, real complaints I have with the book. I mean, the art's really solid. The storytelling is cool. I mean, as I was reading these issues, I didn't really know what I thought. And, you know, there was a lot of, I hate to use the term hype because I feel like that has a negative connotation, but there's a lot of hype around this book because it's so popular and it's very you know, it gets a lot of exposure online, and so, you know, you kind of have I kind of had, like, maybe an unconscious bias about about this going into it. I couldn't tell you really what that bias was.
Just you went into it with preconceptions.
Yeah, preconception. That's better than bias. That's the word I was looking for. But it lives up to. I can see why, now that I've read the first six issues, why this is such a popular comic. Because it is really good. I don't have any... I can't think of any, like I said, any real complaints about this book. So, yeah, 4.5. Oh, and before you rate it, Andy, I was looking at some of the other covers. My favorite is definitely issue number 10, where Carol's wearing the bomber jacket and looking at the stars. And the stars spell out Captain Marvel.
Yeah, that one's great.
That's an awesome, awesome cover. I really love that one. Maybe I'll just buy issue 10 because I love that cover.
There you go, that a boy. See, and I think part of the reason I really like issue number 9 also is because of all the stuff that I've seen people do with it in the fan community. Because Kelly Sue, because I'm on first name basis with her too now, she reblogged on Tumblr somebody had done like a stained glass thing of the cover of number 9. Oh my god, it looks so fucking great. And maybe because that stained glass art was so awesome, that sticks out in my mind so much. That's why I love that cover. I don't know, but it's great design for a cover, and I'm probably biased for that. Anyway, my rating. I'm also going to give it a 4.5. I don't know why I'm not giving it a 5, though, because I feel like as Cape comics go, this deserves a 5. But since we just read Pretty Deadly, which was also by Kelly Sue DeConnick, and I feel like I don't want to say that that's a better comic, but the imagery and interplay between the art and the story felt so much deeper in Pretty Deadly than it does in this. Not that this isn't also a great comic, because I love what this does for female characters. And if you want to, it sounds stupid to talk about comics for ladies and comics you would want to give your woman friend to get her into comics. It sounds stupid, but genuinely, it is not a problem, but my wife wants to know why I'm into comics. My wife wants to read comics to get that something she can do with me. And I've given her things to try. I've given her, like, Long Halloween that she loved, and there's a bunch of things that she enjoys. But there's a whole realm of comics that there's an immediate barrier for so many women with things like Wonder Woman, who, even though she's awesome, that costume is ridiculous. Power Girl, there's an insane barrier to entry for a lot of women just immediately by looking at the character. And I don't even want to talk about whose fault that is. I don't know if that's DC's fault for making a look at that, or if it's society's fault for making women think that that character is then slutty, or the male gaze. Blame aside, this comic genuinely removes that. It removes all of that. And it makes this comic about a person who happens to be a woman, who happens to be surrounded by other strong women. And the only time that their sex is ever an issue, is when they're being denied something because of it. And that's an awesome statement, and it's great storytelling, because it shouldn't matter. And in the only time it does come up in this, and the only time it does matter in this, fucking sucks. It really, really fucking does, to the point where even the protagonist in this story is like, fuck it, I don't want to deal with telling her why it sucks. I want to go off and punch somebody, and I want to punch them for making it this way. And that's great. That's insanely fulfilling. And so, because of all those things, it's like, this genuinely is the comic you should give your girlfriend to get her in the comics. Which is so stupid to say, and I hate saying it, but if you really do want to make a list, and you really do want to... This is a comic I'm giving to everybody, not just because they're women, though. I want to make that clear.
If I may interject something.
Yeah, please, because I'm not articulate.
Every issue that you brought up regarding getting your wife into comics, I have the exact same problem and questions from my boyfriend. So I just want to say again, like last episode, I think we kind of figured out maybe ladies like good comics, and this is a good comic, so just throwing that out there.
And dudes like good comics too. I fucking love this comic. I love what it does about like the interplay and time, and how it uses time travel to bring in Helen Cobb and them and Captain Marvel and the Legacy, and it all blends together beautifully to make a really good just comic. Sorry, David, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, I think last week the question was posed, would I give this to my daughter?
Mm.
Didn't, oh, wasn't, yeah. I think that was,
yeah.
Last. Would I give this to her when she is old enough to read comics? Definitely.
Awesome. No hesitation.
Yeah, no, like Annie said, no hesitation. I definitely would, no question. Because it's a good comic, and it is a, it is a strong female character, but it doesn't feel like, this comic is about being a strong female character, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's just, this is a comic about an awesome person, and it's an awesome comic, so... Yeah, no hesitation. I would definitely give this to her.
So, to wrap up in our second episode of the Comics for Ladies, how do you write a comic that targets a woman? You write a good comic. 2 weeks in a row, same conclusion. Universal 4.5. So we'll see if we maintain this course of ignoring the quote-unquote issue at hand of how to write a comic for ladies. We will read Why the Last Man by Brian K. Vaughan with our from Pia Guerra and Jose Marzan Jr. And there's two comics that are... There's a reason we picked this, because there are two comics that are always on the list for comics to give your wife, girlfriend, whatever, to get them into comics. It's Fables, which we've already read, and this. And Why the Last Man is that for a reason. Have either of you guys read Why the Last Man before?
I have not.
No.
Do you guys know the premise?
Yes.
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and say it then. The main character is a dude who goes to bed one night, and the world's normal, and he wakes up the next day, and he's the only man left alive.
Okay.
And so this will be interesting because this is also the first of the three written by a man. So maybe we can talk about that if that matters at all or ever.
Yeah. Before we go into like the housekeeping part of the show.
Yeah.
This might be like completely irrelevant for our listeners because I'm not sure when this episode is going up. But Kelly Sue DeConnick will be at our local comic book store, Elusive Comics, on August 13th. I think she's going to be there from like 1 to 7.
Yep, I'm taking a half day at work so I can be there for all of it.
Yeah, the first part of her visit will not be a signing, but she'll be doing like a talk or like a Q&A type of thing. And then I think 4 to 7 she's going to do signings.
Yeah, I talked to the shop owner and it's like grab lunch, come on by, hang out, and do a Q&A. So it's kind of like just have lunch and hang out with Kelly Sue DeConnick. So I'm going to be there.
Yeah, like I said, I don't know. I feel like this episode won't be up by then. But we should definitely post some stuff on our various interweb presence.
Oh, and I'll be one of those hella creepy people. I'll put this episode on a CD since it won't be up yet, and I'll give it to her. Be like, we made this for you.
Oh God.
I want to be there when you do that.
Okay. Are you gonna go right after work?
I'm gonna probably leave work early.
Okay.
I'll probably get there around 4.
Okay.
We'll see how busy I am.
I'll be there. I'll wait to give it to her until you're there.
Well, I got a copy of Pretty Deadly number 1 for her to sign.
Nice.
I need to pick up a copy of Avengers Assemble number 9 to get it signed for my son, and then I'm gonna try to get Captain Marvel number. Well, see, I was gonna get number 10 because it's my favorite cover, but it's black because it's a night sky, so I don't know how that's
going. Oh yeah. Mm. Oh wait, you know what? I have. Okay, remind me the day before. I have those like metallic pens that I used at my wedding for our guest book poster.
Oh yeah.
I have a silver one I can bring for you to use with her.
You know what? What's funny? Speaking of metallic pens and Kelly Sue DeConnick, I have a comic signed by her husband, Matt Fraction, that's signed with a metallic pen.
Ooh, they match
the collection.
I think it's Thor Ages of Thunder. Yeah. That was at Comic-Con, actually.
Nice.
But anyways. Oh,
yeah, I have an Iron Fist signed by him, I think, from the same time.
Yeah, I think we're standing in line next to each other.
Yeah, I think probably. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it for this week. Like I said, next week, Why the Last Man? If you want to know what issues are contained in that first volume, or you want to know what we have coming up after that, because we actually have that plan. So if you are interested in that, go to our website, which is www.apsupercast.com. If you have a suggestion for what we should read coming up, we can go ahead and slot it into the schedule, and we'll see if we can get it in before episode 200, because episode 200, guys, that's coming up, and that's going to be when everything changes. Everything's going to change. Nothing will be the same after episode 200. One of us might
die. Yeah, one of us might die. The death of Vandy. Who knows?
There's three headstones. Who's it going to be? No, do what Ecstatics did. Somebody pointed a finger. Death pointed a finger. And we were all standing together. Oh, God. Oh, I should Photoshop that page.
We're going to have to flip a coin.
Roll the die. Anyway, if you guys have a suggestion for what we should read, go ahead and send us an email at...
atomicpoweredsupercast@gmail.com.
Plus, we're on all of the social media stuff, twitter.com/APSupercast, facebook.com/APSupercast, and apsupercast.tumblr.com, which is where Kelly Sudakonic has liked our podcast episode on Pretty Deadly.
She liked. Ooh, she did?
Oh yeah, she did. She really likes us. Guys, we've been getting
frightening.
We get recognition from people whose comics we review, but nobody else listens, I think. Curtis J. Weeb, who did Peter Panzerfaust,
yeah.
Or just posted. He wrote back, and I could tell he listened, because he wrote back, and he was like, thanks, guys. And he says, Tiger Lily comes up next trade. And we talked about that halfway into the episode, so I think he might have actually listened to the whole thing.
Oh, God, that's so scary.
Oh, my God, somebody actually listened to us talking on the internet.
I mean, I kind of hope Kelly Sue listens to this, because then she'll know that we gave her an awesome rating. I kind of don't want her to, because she'll be like, these fucking idiots got nothing. I put all of this in this comic, and they got nothing.
Seriously, this is a terrifying prospect. We've gotten everything wrong.
Excited and scared all at once. Oh, no. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Until next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Ladies.
Ladies.
Oh, ladies.
Uh-huh.